If your passion lies in elite British road racing and you want an inside line on the teams, riders, organisers and sponsors that make this sport such a compelling spectacle, you're in the right place. I'm Timothy John, and joining me for every episode is my co-host, the Managing Director of Brother UK, Bill Jones.
Thanks, Tim. It's great to be here. We're going to use this platform to talk about all the key issues surrounding the sport. With special guests, deep dives into hot topics and plenty of chat, we'll keep you informed about all things UK racing. Stay tuned.
Hello and welcome to this new edition of the Brother UK Cycling Podcast, our 51st no less. And what better way to break the half century than with an episode that finds us back at full strength, on home ground and in the company of cycling royalty. Joining me today is my co-host Phil Jones, the Managing Director of Brother UK and triple Olympic champion Ed Clancy OBE, a man with three gold medals and six rainbow jerseys in the trophy cabinet, but whose journey through cycling seems only to be gaining momentum. Since last October, Phil and Ed have worked closely as members of the Elite Road Racing Task Force, which Ed chaired and which last month published 16 recommendations on 40 action points. Their eagerly anticipated report wasn't the only seismic announcement of the winter, however. A few days later, British Cycling CEO John Dutton unveiled a new initiative to deliver major cycling events in the UK, including the previously imperiled Tours of Britain for men and women. And if that wasn't enough, Brother UK has become the co-title sponsor of Das Hutchinson Brother UK, a British-registered UCI Continental Women's team with 19 riders, and will also serve as the prize fund sponsor of Cold Dark North's proper Northern Road Race Series. Who said that the off-season was quiet? Phil, Ed, thank you very much indeed for joining me today.
Thanks, Tim. Thanks for having me.
Well, our pleasure and privilege to have you with us, Ed. I mentioned there that you were on this new pathway through cycling. You've done the medal-winning bit. You're now the South Yorkshire Active Travel Commissioner. You're the Elite Road Racing Task Force Chairman. You're an ambassador for CAMS, the Cycling Accident Management Service. Are there any more? Are there any there that I've missed?
I think that's about it. I still work with British Cycling on the research and innovation team, and I do a little bit with the commercial team as well. I do some consultancy work with British Triathlon, a bit of public speaking, and I think that's it. But big jack of all trades these days, Tim.
Does it feel like you're busier than ever?
Absolutely, yeah. I think I look back really quite fondly at how little I did other than ride a bike back in the glory days. And of course, it's not easy being a pro cyclist. You know, it's hard, and every day you're trying to overcome adversity in one way or another. But it is simple. It's very one-dimensional, you know, when you get into the real world. And I am busier than ever. But every athlete struggles, I think, it's fair to say, in retirement. And that transition, you see it in military life, you know, it's well publicised with Olympians, ex-football players and whatever. And, you know, it was the same for me. It's been a difficult transition, but I really feel like I'm getting there now. And I'm starting to understand more about what I enjoy, what I don't enjoy. And, of course, it's always good to have a bit of help from your friends, Phil Jones included. So, it's been good.
Excellent. Phil, I mentioned at the top there that we're back at full strength. It's been a few episodes now since you and I were both behind the mic. Great to have you back. A couple of new sponsorships. We're on board with the UCI Continental Women's Team Das Hutchinson Brother UK, and we're the prize fund sponsor for Cold Dark North's proper Northern Road Race Series.
As usual, Tim, there's plenty to discuss. And the big news was the merger of two teams, which was formerly Das Hansling and one of the teams we sponsored, which was Hutchinson Brother UK, into the now newly named Das Hutchinson Brother UK UCI team. So that one was being discussed quite extensively. And I recall having a couple of long conversations with Ian about that, who's obviously Ian Watson, who's the manager of Hutchinson Brother UK, about what the merits and demerits of it would be. And in my view, the merger of these two teams makes a much stronger force, because it's quite a big thing to run a team on your own, which Ian was doing. And of course, on the other side of the house, you had Das Hansling with Simon Howells behind the team, as well as Andrew Payne. And by bringing the two teams together, what they now get is the benefit of that merger, which is they've now got two DSs in terms of Simon and Ian, which spreads that load out. You've got very competent individual in Andrew behind the scenes there doing all of the other things like the organising, the logistics and all those, you know, essential things that need to be done when you run a team. So I think it will actually be better for everybody. It's good for the sport. It's very, very good for the longer term outlook for the team. So that was all very, very exciting. And obviously we've also renewed with what they were called in 2023 was Brother UK Orientation Marketing. And they will revert to become Brother UK On Form in the 2024 season, which I think will be the sixth season we've actually sponsored that development team. So, yeah, lots going on.
Yeah, I mean, both sponsorships make an awful lot of sense. As you say, the UCI Continental Women's Team market is becoming surprisingly crowded. And for Ian and Simon to join forces at the ideal solution, they've been busy in the transfer market already. They've signed up two-time Irish road race champion Alice Sharp, Lincoln Grand Prix winner Robin Clay, European under 23 team pursuit and marathon champion Sophie Lewis. Sophie was on Das Hansling last year and she'll be riding in Brother Colours this year. So makes an awful lot of sense from the sporting side too. I think team management, Ed, it's about the only thing that you haven't done so far, isn't it?
Well, funny you say that. I'm going out to a cycling resort in Girona that I'm doing a bit of work with called Palau Cycling. And I'm taking Giles Pidcock's Fensham House junior team out there for a week. So what Giles is the boss. I'm definitely not going to be running and managing the team, but I'm very much looking forward to getting out there and sitting in the car and shouting move up out the window a few times perhaps. But not yet.
Well, that is some team, Ed. I mean, the amount of young riders who've gone up to World Tour teams or World Tour development teams is unbelievable. I spent a little bit of time with DSM in January and they've got a young lad called Jacob Bush, who last year was one of Giles's lads. I think you took another of them down to the Portsdown Classic, didn't you? Alex Belden, who's now on Trinity.
That's right, yeah. I think Al's been with Giles Pidcock and Fensham House for the last 2 years and he's now moved up to Trinity, which is, I guess, the next logical step for those lads, unless they go straight to an under-23 World Tour development team. But yeah, it's been a massively successful team and it's been good getting to know Giles a little bit over the last couple of months. And, you know, he's probably a little bit like Phil. He's an incredibly busy man. He doesn't need to get involved in the sport, but he has a place in his heart, you know, particularly for youth development and, you know, gives up a lot of his free time and headspace to help these lads get on the ladder. And he's obviously got a relationship with agents. Obviously, Tom Pidcock's got a big name in that world and he's got a great relationship with other under-23 development teams and so on. And he's really passionate about having particularly that first step of the pathway for the young lads to get started in the world of pro cycling.
Phil, you had a long conversation with Giles at the Rainer Foundation dinner, I seem to remember.
Yes, I did. He's a you know, great guy, and as Ed describes, so incredibly passionate, but very, very well connected, very, very commercially minded too. And when you're sort of bridging straight across to someone like Trinity, and obviously we also know Trinity is incredibly well connected straight into the World Tour based upon the sort of the dynasty that sits behind Trinity. So as a result, I think these sort of very, very strong connections are excellent. So if Giles is there, got, you know, fantastic development team, people like Ed, resources, training camps, all of those sorts of stuff, almost with then a guaranteed route into potentially a development rider on a World Tour team, then that sounds pretty good for the future of young riders wanting to enter cycling as a professional career to me.
Well, mentioned in passing there, Ed, Alex Belden and you taking him down to the Portsdown Classic, but you weren't operating as a taxi service there. You were there to race. Do we call it a comeback?
Oh, I don't know about a comeback, but I absolutely loved it. Like everything about that that weekend. So I did the team launch with the junior lads on Saturday and then I picked up Alex Belden, his first year under 23 on the way down. And it was great chatting to him. So we had like a good 5 hours in the car on the travel down to Portsmouth and yeah, it was good seeing him in the race in the bunch. And yeah, I mean, those lads are a cut above where I am these days. And I think he did get 7th or 8th in the end. I think he was best out of the sort of the bunch sprint, if you like, at the top of the last climb. And yeah, I really enjoyed the weekend, the racing, the meeting Alex and seeing how he's doing with his career and trying to impart a little bit of wisdom. But yeah, I wouldn't expect much more of a comeback than 45th place.
Did you notice any difference in the racing style from sort of when you were, you know, on JLT and Vitus? So, you know, here you are again, suddenly with your leg over a bike, which I thought was absolutely brilliant. What did you notice about the racing style, you know, since you were last out there yourself?
Yeah, good question. I think for me personally, it's the first time I've rode in a British race and not been part of a big British team. So, I mean, straight away, there was no impetus on me to sort of get on the front and chase things back and bring brakes back. And I think that was kind of like a running theme of the race. So we had St. Piran there, which were very much the dominant team. And there was other teams there. But I don't think this is no news. This is not new news, rather. But there was nobody that could coordinate a solid chase or had the impetus to coordinate a solid chase to do anything about it. So it was very much just a case of a brake's gone. There's a few St. Piran lads in it that feel confident. And of course it yo-yos as it does, but it was never coming back. And I mean, I guess in an ideal world, you'd have multiple teams that are all capable of winning. But I think right now, and has been the case for a couple of years, you know, St. Piran are a dominant force and they sometimes make it look easy.
Well, let's give our listeners a little bit of background on this race that we're now discussing in some detail. It's now called the Portsdown Classic, but long-term listeners might recognise it as the Perth's Pedal Race. Has been revived, saved even, by a race organiser called Seb Otley. It's a short, hard 45-mile Nat-B race held near Portsmouth. It was staged on February the 11th and won by Sam Culverwell of St. Piran. Second was Jamie Wiltshire of Bournemouth Cycle Works VTEC Fire. And third was Robin Barker, another St. Piran rider. Well, that mention there of Seb Otley, a race organiser, gives us a very nice lead, doesn't it, into the main business of the day. Let's talk now in some detail about the Elite Road Racing Task Force. This is a major initiative which both of you have been involved with for some time. Again, let's bring people back up to speed. It was commissioned last August by British Cycling CEO John Dutton and was given a remit to consider the Elite Road Racing Calendar. That's the National Road Series and National Circuit Series. The challenges facing domestic teams and opportunities to grow the reach and profile of the sport. There were eight people on this panel, including Ed, of course, who chaired it, and Phil, who, as we've already mentioned, worked very closely with Ed. It also included team manager John Herity, race organiser Chris Lawrence, marketing experts Jess Morgan and Steve Fry, and riders Joe Tindley and Monica Greenwood. Now, the panel followed a five-step problem-solving mechanism: diagnosis, discovery, debrief, decisions and direction, and they published an initial analysis based on the discovery phase last October. 2 weeks ago, however, the panel published 16 recommendations based on 40 action points, which British Cycling has pledged to take forwards. So how do you reflect now, both of you, both Phil and Ed, on this long and detailed process behind the report? It's a big chunk of work, isn't it, to which both of you have given a significant amount of time. Ed, how was it for you, your first experience in chairing a panel, I'd imagine?
It was, yeah. So I met John Dutton for the first time, probably about a year and a half ago now, out at an event, not long after I've retired, in Tokyo. It sounds glamorous, but it wasn't. We were out in Dubai at an event, and I met him, we had a meal with him, exchanged pleasantries and sort of said our goodbyes, and that's the last I heard of him until about 6-9 months later. He was a new CEO of British Cycling. And I guess at that point, I dropped him a message and said hello and congratulated him on the new job and just sort of like offered a handout and said, hey, if you ever need anything, let me know. And he took me up on the offer and, you know, we had a little meeting. And again, we sort of went our separate ways. And a couple of months later, we came back and he said, Ed, I'm really happy with where Grassroots is and sort of like, you know, participation in the sport and so on. He's very happy with the top end of the sport, like how the Olympic team's getting on under the watchful eye of performance director Stephen Spark. But there was this complicated middle ground that had, as we all know, experienced this wonderful sort of boom period between 2008 and perhaps 2018, a great decade of exciting racing. We had a proper domestic scene in itself, and really, that's been struggling, as we all know, and he wanted to commission a little task force that included myself and Phil and everybody else you've just mentioned to put some recommendations to him. And I guess it's got to say, first things first, hats off to John. He could have quite easily sort of said, let's go where the energy's going, wherever it is, sportifs, gravel rides. But no, I really think that he wants this to work. But in terms of answering your question, I think it was very much a worthwhile process. And yeah, I think it's absolutely a necessary first step just to have a pragmatic roadmap that British Cycling can now hopefully choose to follow to start to turn this oil tanker around.
Well, Phil, far from your first experience in what I guess is a version of corporate life, this bringing people together with different skill sets to solve a very complex issue, you must have been in your element.
Yes, this is the sort of bread and butter stuff that we do all the time in corporate life, which is, you know, create strategic plans, strategic roadmaps, try and diagnose problems, try and look at how you break problems down, how you bring different qualities to the problem-solving process. So it was very sort of familiar ground to me. But I just want to make the point, I guess, that as Ed's described there, that I think it was a courageous decision by John to sort of go, okay, we're going to get this going. Because, of course, BC don't just look after elite road cycling. They've got a whole portfolio of different cycling sports that they're responsible for. And, of course, quite rightly, if you start a task force for this, then every other part of the sport is going to say, well, when are we having our task force? Because everybody wants to have more funding, better organisation and all these sorts of things. So, but you have to start somewhere, don't you? You have to start somewhere. And I guess this was based upon, if you were listening to sort of the negative voices in cycling, there was a huge amount of negative voices around the state of the sport, one would guess. And that's a lot of those negative voices were just pointing at British Cycling saying, you're dysfunctional, you're failing, it's your fault. But our job was to sort of come in as a sort of combined group of brains is to try and look at, well, why have we got to where we've got to? You know, what's happened? What happened in the past? What's the journey been? Why are we here? And then to try and decide, well, okay, if that was the current state, what we call the current state, what we then look at is what we want what we call the to be state to be. So actually, if that's where we are, what do we want to be? Then how on earth do we get there? I guess is the sort of the very simple way that you would describe it. So when John got hold of me and just said, look, would you jump on and help? I was like, well, I would, because I think it's very easy to stand on the sidelines sometimes, isn't it? It's very, very easy. There's a lot of people standing on the sidelines. There are who are critical of the sport and are very quick to jump on and be negative. But it's like, okay, well what are you going to do to try and help it rather than just be noisy? And I think that sometimes you've got to just maybe just step up and go, okay, well, let's see what we can do. So for all of us involved, that's Ed, myself, and the six other members, yeah, we have contributed a lot of our personal time, given up our evenings, given up, you know, daytimes to help to solve this, because otherwise, who else is going to do it? You know, BC would probably need to bring in a set of management consultants to do this at great cost. But actually, would they really have the knowledge? Would they be able to fast track this outcome? And I believe, although it's taken some months for us to get to where we've got to, we've managed to achieve in some months what it would have probably taken a set of management consultants a lot longer to achieve, at least this first set of recommendations that we pushed back to BC.
I mean, it struck me, guys, fairly early on that there was a pretty unique mix of skill sets here. In John Herity, you've probably got the most respected manager in the history of domestic road racing. In Joe Tindley, you've got a former national circuit race champion. Ed, of course, your riding career speaks for itself. Chris Lawrence organises the Newark Town Centre races. He organises the Dudley Grand Prix. He was involved with the Barnsley Town Centre races. But you also have people on the panel with commercial acumen, people who understand the marketing game. So how did that all come together? I mean, did they prove to be complementary skills? Was there any friction to overcome? Did you pretty soon establish a working method? Ed, you were trying to keep all these people in line.
Yeah. So I guess it was my job to be inquisitive by nature, which is easy done for me. And I like, at this point, like Phil said, you know, this process is bread and butter for him. And I lent on Phil heavily for that five-stage structure that I think Phil gave across to me after the very first session and said, Ed, let's have a look at working with a framework here. And yeah, I remember we shared a few WhatsApps backwards and forwards, and we quite quickly got to this idea that, you know, we need to create these problem buckets and opportunity buckets. And then we had sporting buckets. So we're talking about the task force members. And fortunately, we had Joe and Monica that are very much here and present in terms of the latest sporting problems. In terms of the commercial side of things, we've got the wonderful Phil Jones. And in terms of PR, media, we had Jess, Steve Fry. And like you say, I think we had all the component parts. We had a great team. There was no bickering. There was no falling out. And I think we had every angle covered. I haven't mentioned Chris Lawrence yet, but he's really well connected. In the cycling world in general, you know, particularly with the organisers, in and out in British cycling. And incredibly passionate as well. And I think between us, we had all aspects covered. And, you know, we went on this discovery phase, which we might go into a little bit. And we got, hundreds of people coming back to us, you know, either for face-to-face interviews within British Cycling, completing surveys. And that's like the empirical evidence we've got. Anecdotally, we probably had tens of thousands of voices, you know, being fed into myself, into Chris Lawrence, into Phil, both present and from over the years. And we had a great team.
Phil, how was it for you? I mean, I guess you're used to sitting down with a sales director or a chief marketing officer or a chief technical officer, and maybe not John Herity or an Olympic champion or a British circuit race champion. How different was the atmosphere? How different was the vibe from people working in sport than in corporate life?
Yeah, I guess you would immediately find there's a lot of passion that probably sometimes in corporate life we're probably a bit less emotional and we're just a bit more functional when it comes to those sorts of things. But I think that was a really good thing, because that passion actually is what needs to turbocharge some of the outcomes that we were all working on. But I just want to loop back to something Ed said there, which I thought was really a really good point, which is I know when the task force was first announced, there were some people that were saying, oh, well, you know, it's too small. There's lots of other people that should be on it. And you've missed this person or you've missed that person. All my experience, having been doing this for a couple of decades now, one of the things when you're trying to deal with these really, really complex problems is you need to actually have a fairly small group doing it. But what you do when you create that group is you ensure that that group are well networked. That is, those individuals can pull on their second level connections and third level connections to gain information quickly. So as Ed describes there, we've got what we would describe in the trade as qualitative information and quantitative information. So the numbers, surveys, etc., but then also the anecdotal stuff that's coming back. And so we had to make sure that everybody who, that's very small crack team that was basically pulled together, pretty much knew everybody. We knew all the media people, we knew the race organisers, the riders and all the other riders and the teams and the team managers and all these sorts of things. You know, John could speak to pretty much anybody. So that meant a lot of the, let's say, discussions which needed to be longer and deeper could quite easily be had. And it also meant that that could be debriefed back into the task force incredibly quickly. So let's say somebody who might be influential, whether that be Denny at the British Continental or Larry at Velo UK, who have been in the sport a long time, who are commentators, who have specific things that they want to feed back in, they were listened to very deeply in order that we could pull that knowledge and pull all of that information into our pool very, very quickly to discuss it, debate it, and process it. And as Ed described there, it really doesn't matter actually that we were solving a problem in cycling, because as long as you're following a framework and a process, it almost doesn't matter what the industry is or the sector is, the process takes you through. And that was the key thing, really, is you get the right team, then you apply the right process to it. And then by applying that right process, you take people through that journey and you ultimately come out at an end of something, which is you've got a, a list of things which you prioritise, and then you decide what you want to do with them, what's important, what's not important, what's in your control, what's not in your control, what will have high impact, what will not have high impact. So I think what we saw was all individuals involved on the task force able to make very positive net contributions. And what that means is you know, they're bringing their individual expertise to the table. And there's things that I definitely don't know about the sport. I've never raced a bike race in my life. I've never run a team. But I could hear from the expertise of the people in the room what that meant, what the real problems were that they were experiencing, what the real issues that meant something to the riders here and now today, not 10 years ago when the sport was at its heyday, but actually here and now. What are the practical things that are on the desks of team managers right now and riders about the way races are organised, how they're supported by the federation, what their view is about race organisation, all those sorts of things. So, you know, in my view, in terms of the footprint of the sport that we were able to cover in the speed that we're able to cover it, I think it was a pretty good outcome.
Well, it sounds like you had a good group dynamic, and were able to get through this huge challenge at a fairly decent rate. With that said, there was a lot to consider, wasn't there? Marketing, technical aspects of race organisation, safety, the geography of the calendar, an awful lot to plough through. Was it difficult to meet that January deadline? Would you have liked longer? And if you'd had longer, would there have been more or different recommendations? What do you think, Ed? I mean, had you seen enough of it by January, or would you have liked a bit longer to work on it?
Well, I think first things first, I think the initial idea was that we got it completed by the end of 2023. And I think we all relatively early on realised that whilst we could have done it by the end of 2023, we wanted to do it right. And again, it was just one of Phil's suggestions that we went on this discovery phase. So we didn't just want to sit around in our circle of eight people, despite all the anecdotal evidence that we had. You know, we wanted to reach out, to bring people in for one-on-one interviews, managers, organisers, volunteers, riders. And yeah, I think everything we heard there, it really helped confirm what we thought we already knew, to be fair. I don't think we reached out to everyone and we didn't find any silver bullet, if that makes sense. You know, it was good that it gave us confidence that we were on the right path. We were thinking the right things. All these hurdles and barriers that we were talking about were confirmed by everyone we reached out to. And that discovery phase took time. And it took British Cycling resource and effort, you know, to go out there, to write these surveys, to give people time to come back. And for what it's worth, I'm glad we did that. I'm glad we missed the original deadline. But I'm also glad that, yeah, We worked hard. Like Phil said, we spent almost every week we were on a Zoom call, you know, sometimes till sort of half nine p.m. at night after everyone had sort of come back and had dinner. And I think it was important that we got it out at the start of this year so we can give British Cycling a chance to act upon these recommendations. And, you know, some things will start taking place by the end of this year and some things will take a few years to act upon.
Well, obviously a very busy schedule and obviously a large amount accomplished. Phil, as you look back on those 40 action points, 16 of which have gone before the public, are you satisfied? Was that targeted remit sufficient for you to get to grips with the underlying challenges of the scene? Just to recap, the remit was the composition of the elite national calendar, the challenges facing domestic teams, and opportunities to grow the reach and profile of domestic races. Did that give you sufficient scope?
Yes, I think so. Actually, what I would say is the fact that it was a narrow scope probably helped a lot, because if the scope had been much wider, you would have ended up having to go right the way through the B scene and then right the way down to the junior scene and go up to the World Tour. You'd need to understand all the interconnectivity between all of those things. So whilst we did, and whilst we understood what those influencing factors were about, you know, the importance of B races, then the importance of the A races, and then into European racing and World Tour. We understood all of that. But I think what you have to do when you're running a project like this is you have to make sure that you're keeping people on track. And Ed was very good at that, by the way. You know, One thing I'll say about Ed is, even though it's his first time in the chair, you can tell why Ed is a successful Olympian, because what Ed does is he listens a lot, and he learns a lot, and he absorbs a lot, and you know, the next time he asks good questions. That's what a good chair needs to do, actually, is just to bring a group together and to bring things out. So what you've also got to do is you've got to keep things on track. And where someone might go off on one about, oh, you know, about this or about that, you've got to come back and go, does that influence the outcome that we are trying to generate here, i.e. the scope and the mandate that we've been given? So there were things, but you have to push them to one side and go, that's not us, that's somebody else, for somebody else to solve. So within it all, clearly there are a huge amount of influencing factors here. Some are very, very easy to put your hands onto. We could sort of quite easily put our hands on the issue of aging nature of race organizers, so that actually the average age is getting older, some are retiring from the sport, deciding not to do it anymore. That's an easy one to point at and go, oh, that's an easy one. So what we're going to do there is try and bring younger organizers. We need to try and do some knowledge transfer. There needs to be better training. There needs to be more education. There needs to be more encouragement and motivation for people to do it and to start races, etc. That's quite easy. But when you look at the, well, actually, why has the sport got to where it's got to question, then there's even bigger factors going on, such as the post-pandemic global economy, the wars that are going on globally, that all are influencing the trading environment, for example, commercial sponsorship. And then races and teams require commercial sponsorship. So why can't they get commercial sponsorship? Should it not be easy? Well, actually, it's because businesses are tightening their belts, they're shutting down on discretionary spend, etc. So the sport, like many sports, it's not exclusive to elite road racing. You go around any sport and you talk about how easy it is to get sponsors right now, and everybody will tell you a tale of woe. The sport of elite road racing has been squeezed as a result of some of the macro global economic things that are going on, which have been impacting our economies. Now, Ed, as a cycling commissioner, knows how now budgets in, you know, local authorities have been squeezed desperately. And so they're all running on, you know, fumes right now, a lot of these local authorities. So they're having to make choices about where they spend their money. And what might have been an easy one, or let's throw some money at a circuit series race 5 years ago. Now, if they haven't got enough money to get the bins emptied where you live, then they're going to put the money into getting the bins emptied because it's politically the right thing to do. So all of these other mitigating factors are happening. Well, is that in our control to solve that? Well, no, it's not. It's not in our control to solve that. So how on earth do we try and navigate through that? And I think this is where we began to think about, you know, this is not going to be solved immediately. The global economy is not going to recover overnight. The British economy is still, you know, stifling after Brexit. We've got all of these issues going on. So all we can do, I think, is create a direction of travel that, if as long as we follow that direction of travel, the end result will come. But the question will be is actually, can you put your finger on what year that end result will come in? Well, I don't think we can right now, but there are certainly building blocks that we've identified of some easy things to do, which are in our control, which can be done, which will have an impact on the sport. There are some other things that will take a little bit more time. An example being getting more races in the south of England. It's an obvious one, isn't it? You know, you look at the calendar and go, oh, well, to solve the sport, what we need to do is put another 3 or 4 races on in the south. And you go, but that's easier said than done, because you might need, as an organiser, £40,000 to £60,000 in commercial sponsorship to even start that. If you're looking at road closures, you're looking at a minimum of £1,000 for every police motorbike that turns up to create a rolling bubble. They're huge costs. So then the discussion goes, does it not? Well, you've got to reduce the costs. Well, it's like, well, okay, yes, you can do some of those things. You could perhaps have clever course designs, shorter courses with more laps, for example, to try and minimise the impact on road closures. But at the minute, the cost of a police motorbike is not changing. So you can't just sort of wander over and go, look, can you do it for 300 for us as a favour? It's not happening. You know, that's the cost. So dealing with all of these things, you know, together, it's like, look, if somebody had given us £50 million budget and you knew that was coming from central government and said, right, Ed, actually, your job as chair is you've got 50 million quid and you've got to decide how to spend it to revive the sport. I should think we might have had a nice few evenings out somewhere and we'd have come up with lots of really good ideas. But the reality is there's not enough money about, there's not enough expertise about right now. British Cycling's resources, in my opinion, are still need better resourcing effectively. So we've got to only try and work with what we've got. And I think that was one of the difficulties when we put the report out is actually we should narrow it down because not everything is actually, you know, really, you know, instantly achievable in, let's say, in the next 3 years. Let's try and focus on things that can be done in the next 3 years, perhaps.
Ed, if you had a single word to describe this report, what would that be?
Yeah. Just one word. Is that all you're going to give me, Tim?
Yeah.
Ah, I don't know. I think attainables is the obvious one, but if I could have three, it'd be logical, pragmatic, and attainable for the reasons Phil said. You know, if we gave the recommendation, we should have a big Netflix series to come and like follow the National Circuit Series around and the Road Series. Yes, of course, that'd bring in loads of money, loads of sponsorship, loads of attention, and it'd boom overnight. If we gave the recommendation to British Cycling, we recommend you invest £10 million in the domestic road racing scene. It's just not on the cards. You know, we tried hard to make logical, pragmatic and attainable recommendations that could be implemented. And I think there was some sort of frustration out there that only in parts, I think generally speaking, it was really, really well received. All the recommendations, really well received. Where there was disappointment, it's that there was no... There was no easy solution, and there isn't any. And despite all our best efforts, going on this big discovery journey, everything all these experts in the room knew and know, there's certain things that we can control within our circle of influence, and I believe every single thing that we can control within reason is in that list.
Yeah, I mean, you said some negativity, and I'd agree with you. Most of the responses that I've encountered, anecdotally or through the prism of social media, have been remarkably positive. It's been well received, I think. In terms of the time frame, though, 3 years, I think, was quoted in the report. Do people understand that, do you think? I mean, are there still hearts and minds to win here?
You know what? If there is frustration that things can't happen overnight, I'm happy to take a stick for that. I like to see people passionate about the sport. I like to see people impatient. And, you know, we briefly mentioned the Portsdown Classic that I rode last weekend, and it was ace. Phil mentioned how passionate people are about sport, and I am too. I'm impatient, and everyone, you know, when we zoom out from this, and if there's one thing, there's one message I can get across on this podcast, it's that we've all got to stop asking, what's our sport going to do for us? And we've got to start asking, you know, what can we do for our sport? Whether you're Phil Jones and you're throwing money at a few teams and a few races, whether you're Ed Clancy, who doesn't have money to throw around, but he can turn up, he can chair task force, you know, he can put in his spare time, whether you happen to be meeting the local councillor in a random meeting and you can speak about the positive benefits of people getting out and being fit and active. And I think, all that stuff costs nothing. And, if nothing else, I do think that this task force has raised the profile of the issue, and there's some positive energy about the place again.
And I expect you do meet councillors in your role as active travel commissioner for South Yorkshire, Ed. I mean, Phil mentioned there that a lot of local authorities are running on fumes. I think that was the phrase you used there, Phil. And clearly, delivering core services is always going to be prioritised over a bike race. Is it as straightforward as giving councils a black and white choice these days? I mean, are there avenues, are there angles that cycling can explore to unlock those local authority budgets?
I believe so, yeah. And, you know, from working within South Yorkshire Mayoral Combined Authorities, you know, which encompasses Doncaster, Rotherham, Barnsley and Sheffield, I think, yeah, it's people believe in the youth. People believe in children's mental, physical health. They know that there's thousands of independent studies have shown that, you know, particularly in young people, if they're physically active, mentally, they're always in a better place. They can concentrate better at school. If they can create habits young, they'll have the habit of walking or cycling or whatever it is into the sort of teenage years and into adulthood. And there's massive economic benefits that are attached with that in terms of extending your working life, reducing the burden on the NHS. So to answer your question, what are local authorities interested in seeing? Legacy off the back of these events. I think the days of hosting a bike race, particularly the sort of circuit series, a load of men and women will turn up, race their bike for a couple of hours and off it goes. You know, that's one thing. But if we can surround that with mass participation events, sportifs, bikeability sessions or whatever it is, community engagement events, I think that's good for all those reasons I've mentioned prior. And again, if you know, if you can do things that encompass local businesses, local schools, it becomes much safer politically for them as well. And in a nutshell, it's going to have to be more than a bike race. But yes, I do believe they still want it and they will make room for it in their budgets.
Well, it's good to know. I mean, it used to be all about we can bring football to the town centre, but now it's a much wider target, isn't it? It's active travel, it's well-being, it's all of those social targets that a local authority must achieve as well as delivering the core services. Phil, one of the things that jumped off the page at me where I thought, well, clearly Phil's had an input here, is the recommendation that the National Road Series and the National Circuit Series be allowed to target a separate sponsorship, a separate title sponsor from British Cycling. I mean, we heard that, didn't we, a couple of seasons ago now from Peter Harrison up at the Beaumont Trophy in the time that British Cycling was sponsored by HSBC and the local organisers were having to give up advertising space on the banners and in the programmes to accommodate HSBC, which was causing them to tear out their hair. So this recommendation that the National Circuit Series and the National Road Series might have a different title sponsor to BC, how significant could that be?
I think this came out of some of these deeper dive discussions that what you're trying to do is sort of unpack where you've got to. And you know, one of the obvious questions is, from a commercial point of view, is that you've got your title sponsor covering everything. And of course, obviously we know that there's an incredible amount of contention around the current major sponsor for British Cycling in Shell. And of course, that's led to an awful lot of inbound negative PR and impact, I guess, to the Federation. So you're looking at it all and going, okay, when we look backwards at the years gone by, there were separate sponsors for the National Road Series. They had their own separate commercial sponsor, distinct from the major sponsor for the Federation. So it's kind of like, so what changed? And probably at some point, that just all got wrapped up in a bigger deal because somebody was trying to, you know, land somebody big like HSBC. So they rolled all the rights up and, of course, that got sold on. You know, one very famous thing that working for a Japanese company is that we have this sort of saying, you've got to understand how the work works. So, you know, you can be strategic, of course you can, but you must understand how the work works. So how does it build up? How do we get things done? And so when we look at that and go, okay, well, how does commercial sponsorship in the organization currently work? And you start to unpack it to understand how it all works. That was one of the obvious questions was, can this be carved off again in order that road racing can take some of the sponsorship that's coming into the federation and directly put it back into the sport? Can it do that? And the answer was, well, yes, in reality, it could happen like that. Again, it's like, well, okay, then. Well, that's quite a good thing then, isn't it? Because probably there could well be what I would call second-tier sponsors out there who don't have the money or perhaps even the inclination or the brand strategy to want to do everything in cycling. But they might look at road cycling and go, well, actually, we're a wheel manufacturer or a road bike manufacturer or we're a nutrition brand or a clothing brand or something where carving that audience off is of interest to us and fits our marketing and brand needs spot on. So that seems sort of quite an obvious one for me. And I think if you look across all the sports in the portfolio, if I was BC, I'd be doing it for every sport. So BMX can have its own sponsor. Mountain bikes can have their own sponsor. Road racing, gravel, you know, whoever, those individual rights are carved off. If somebody still can retain the overall thing, that's fine, because somebody wants to go to the Olympics and have, you know, their logo on a jersey, perhaps. But there needs to be a slightly more sophisticated and commercially astute model, in my opinion, in order to drive additional income streams back to the sport, because there isn't a lot of new money coming into BC. I think in reality, their budgets are probably being cut by, you know, the people that fund them from government, from Sport England and all these sorts of things. We know membership has declined. So John and his commercial teams are going to have to find new money. And as a result of that, when we were discussing it in the task force, you're going to have to find ways to build new income streams that actually, for once, begin to put money back into the sport that can be reinvested in either training or television or social media or all the other things that it needs. Everything in reality starts with money. So unless you solve the money issue, you know, we're never going to probably get the sport back up to its halcyon days of when NFTO were there and JLT, all, you know, all these great teams with fabulous motorhomes and big budgets and star riders like Ed Clancy and Dean Downing and Russ Downing, you know, all of these superstars of back in the day. You know, it's money. Start with money. When you get the money bit right, everything can sort of flow from there. So that's going to take a while, Tim.
Well, I tell you what, my bill from British Gas isn't getting any smaller. Tesco now measures its profits in the billions and must have a store in every town where there's a National Circuit Series event. The banks and the City of London are always awash with money. I mean, my goodness, if the sport could land one of those, then those halcyon days would come back in a hurry. Ed, you mentioned that phrase earlier, and Phil's just mentioned Rafa Condor, NFTO. And I remember 2012, 2013, 2014, and the domestic scene looked like the world tour. I mean, did the panel give any consideration to the impact of presentation going along to a domestic race and seeing some trace of the professional sport is incredibly inspiring? I noted that there was a recommendation to have a look at the regulations for circuit racing to make it easier for world tour riders to enter those races. And you can just imagine, can't you? Connor Swift, for example, in full Ineos kit on the Pinarello bike. Suddenly there's a bit of pizzazz. Suddenly there's a bit of flair. Did the panel think about that?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think there's a recommendation to have a full review into such things. And you kind of mentioned the brand needs a refresh. And, you know, there's this idea that like a franchise works incredibly well. You know, if you're a local authority and you want to buy into a town centre race, you know, what is it? What does it look like? What's its branding? And I guess we want to get to this this point where we have a brand, an image, certain criteria where, you know, if a council buys a town centre race, they know what they're getting. They know if there's a VIP area, you know what branding it's got on the side of it, and almost like a little franchise model. And I think, again, that'll make it easier to sell. And sort of going back to the point before about British Cycling having the need to look for money, and the good news is, I was at a commercial event, a business development event rather, in central London just last week with British Cycling, and they're trying. They're doing all the right things as far as I can see. And, you know, we're in central London. There was a lot of, you know, heavy hitting financial organisations in there, sort of people from the food industry, coffee industry, and so on. And I think that's important because I don't think cycling has been very, not the word, like inventive in the past. I think because we're cycling, we'll go to cycling brands, right? It's natural. Cycling clothing, bicycle manufacturers to look for sponsorship and so on. And, you know, guess who else is struggling right now? The cycling trade, right? So I think the fact that British Cycling were doing a business development event in central London, outside the usual circles, I think it's a move in the right direction. And, you know, I hate to say it, but I do think, yeah, it'll land in a decent sponsor for the Road Seek series or the Circuit series. And like Phil said, I've always thought it'd be a good idea if they could find sponsors that suit BMX, mountain bike, road racing, circuit racing, or whatever it is, that'd be a good thing.
Do you think, Phil, the Circuit Series offers more potential for innovation in that it's more controllable? I mean, it's infinitely more controllable than a road race. Could it become cycling's 2020 cricket?
Yes, that was the conclusion, I think, of the task force when we talked about it in great detail, that actually, if you're going to make a show, then better to make that show in a city centre with high traffic, with a large population. But you bring it, you don't make it just sort of binary. You just bring together all sports. So you absolutely, I can remember going to Bracknell Sports Centre in something like 1983 to see the Skyway team, you know, with people like Billy Stapple that were pulling amazing stunts, and it inspired me to sort of want to ride a BMX. You could have the World Wheeling Championships, and I think Ed Clancy could possibly enter that one as well. Well known for his wheeling prowess. But fundamentally, when you look at, and we looked at some of the playbooks of the races and the circuit centre races that are doing really well right now. And why do they do really well? Because they integrate everything economically, you know, transportation, health agenda, you know, active travel. They pull all of it together and they put it all on one day so that everybody feels like they're getting something out of it. There's kids races, there's food vendors, so that the councils are happy, that the economy is getting driven, the active health agenda, you've got, you know, kids racing, all of these sorts of things. That surely has got to be the winning pat that Ed describes there of what the franchise, so what we really need to be able to take is have that playbook of wherever you land it, you get a sort of a product delivered, which is of a certain standard. Whereas at the moment, not everything is coordinated in the same way. And obviously, I'm sure we're going to come on to it, but obviously we had in circuit races, we had Sweet Spot delivering the Tour Series with one set of deliverables. And of course, we had the National Circuit Series, which of course was then relying on race organisers in different places. So the product delivery could be very, very different. And likewise, you go to, we've seen some tour series that have gone across the country, and I'm sure Ed's raced in a few of them, where some you'd go to packed out, others you might go to, and actually you'd have about 50 people at the side of a circuit. And they'd position the television cameras to make it look busy. But actually, if you were on the ground, you'd realise there was hardly anybody there. So that, you know, we're not, I don't think that the sport was doing itself any favours fundamentally by allowing those sorts of things to happen. So moving forward, it has to coordinate itself better, develop higher standards, minimum standards, and playbooks upon which then a consistent delivery model can be delivered. Once you start getting that right, you can begin to package that up better, and then you can begin to go somewhere with it. But until that happens, it's still not quite the product yet, and it needs to fundamentally become a product, the city centre racing, with multiple parts of the sport, multiple benefits for the local authority, and guaranteed to bring tens of thousands of people, frankly, into a city centre.
Yeah, I mean, it can be done. We've seen it done. Ed, I'm sure you remember the Tour Series in Salisbury, which was a town desperate to recover after the poisoning. I don't know if you remember that.
I do. You know what? As Phil was speaking there, I was literally trying to think of the name of the town down south near the big army base that was the car park afterwards in Salisbury. It was just, you couldn't move. It's a huge, great place, a huge, great area, just rammed with people shoulder to shoulder. And it was a fantastic thing to, you know, to race on home turf with, you know, a pack of your best mates and have, you know, so much support from. It wasn't just the cycling crowd that, you know, came to watch those events. It was just locals, families, local businesses. And yeah, you know, Phil sort of said already, like, they sort of do two different purposes, or two slightly different purposes, rather. You know, circuit series, you could argue, very simplistically, it's more about entertainment being a commercially viable thing. And again, very simplistically, road racing domestically has never really stood on its own two feet financially, but it's always been about having a pathway to other things. And when we did our survey, 52% of the riders that came back to us said that they wanted to make a career out of it. So I do believe we can get back to that point where we have a commercially successful, thriving circuit series, as well as a road race series that's thriving in its own right.
So, Tim, I also want to come back to your point about one of the recommendations here, which was a sort of slight change in the regulations to allow World Tour riders to participate. Because, again, this becomes part of the draw, doesn't it? You got a big star suddenly, finally, you know, able to quickly participate, even if it's for one race. You only got to go to places like, you know, when the Tour of Britain was running, and I've been to, you know, a lot of stages. The number one bus, which has the biggest crowds around it, what was Sky, now Ineos. Without question, they had the biggest crowds, you know, the largest number of people crowded around looking to see riders. So the question there is, and is actually, you've got to be able to use that to, you know, wherever possible, that if a rider happens to be free in their schedule and they go, well, yeah, do you know what? Yeah, I could race a crit. I could do a Tuesday night or a Wednesday night. And, you know, the sporting director signed it off. Everyone's quite happy. You know, suddenly you've got this ability where somebody's got a superstar potentially, you know, going to be on that circuit. So it does help. It's an additional thing that potentially draw crowds. So, these are some of the simple things, really. What's preventing that was a regulation. Okay, well, let's just make a regulation change. That's for the Road Commission and then all the various other people to then start to process.
Well, chapeau for suggesting that, because I remember the London Nocturne. I was the editor of a website at the time called roadcyclinguk.com, and our office literally overlooked the circuit in Smithfield Market. And every year the organiser would come along and say, hey, we've got Alex Towsett, we've got Ian Stannard, we've got Laura Trott. And that made all the difference in the world. I mean, if I could add a 17th recommendation to the 16 that you guys have come up with, it would be engage Ineos. It is a company awash with money. It is the richest team in professional cycling. It is Britain's only World Tour team. And wouldn't you know it, they're one of the few that doesn't have a development team. I mean, my goodness, it's almost as if they're crying out for access to the best British talent, which is currently going to Team DSM, Firmenich, Post NL, Groupama FDJ, and elsewhere. I mean, to me, it would be an ideal marriage if you could bring that World Tour glamour to domestic races, and in return, you could provide a stream of talent to Britain's only World Tour team. Two sides of the same coin. Anyway, Phil.
Tim, here's a little factoid for you, right? So guess what the name of the pub is at the end of the mews where Sir Jim Radcliffe lives when he comes to London? It's called the Grenadier. I think, Ed, me and you need to go down the Grenadier, sit ourselves in that pub for a couple of nights. We'll meet Jim and we'll see if we can tap him up for 30 or 50 million. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that's a great idea. And I think we can, me and you, Phil, we can definitely act out on that 17th recommendation, Tim. If he wanted an under-23 development team, I'd be all over it. I really think that'd be a great thing for domestic racing, to have a pipeline of riders for Team Ineos. I mean, this is a world I know slightly less about, but it would seem that they don't have a development team like FDJ have Jumbo Visma right now. And yeah, we won't go down that rabbit hole.
Well, we talked about crit racing in depth. Let's go to the other end of the spectrum now. One of the recommendations was for a guaranteed stage race each season of at least 3 days. And I wondered, you know, what is the best way to achieve that? Do you say to Jonathan Day and his team, this newly formed British Cycling Events team, look, this is your baby, this is your one contribution per year to the National Road Series? Do you put it out to tender to a professional organiser? Do you corral together a super team of volunteer organisers, people like Mark Etches, Chris Lawrence, Colin Clues? I mean, how do you make that happen? How do you make that 3-day stage race happen each year?
Good question. And it's a tough one, that, Tim. And I guess the short answer is, I don't know. But I do know that there's definitely, when you zoom out again, there's passionate people within British Cycling Events team that have a wealth of knowledge. There's absolutely passionate people that have a wealth of knowledge in terms of those super organisers, Mark Etches, Chris Lawrence, for example. Between them, have they got everything that they need to make it happen? Yeah, absolutely. Do they need to put it out to tender to a separate events organisation? I guess my initial impressions would be not, unless they're very, very confident that they're going to do a better job than the combined efforts of British Cycling's events team. And the super organisers, you know, James Hawkins, Seb Otley, Chris Lawrence and so on. That's my initial thoughts. But I'd love to put that one to Chris or Phil Jones, for example. But that's my initial impressions, yeah.
Tim, there's a couple of comments I'd make on that. One was that obviously that's just a commercial thing, really. There is not lacking intelligence and resources and human resources to pull a three-day together. That's not the thing that's lacking. It's actually, number one is the course and number two is money. So you know, one of the things that we spoke about in the task force was actually, let's look back at race courses which did exist, which no longer exist. And why don't they exist anymore, for example? And there are races, looking back over 10, 15, 20 years, which were courses. And it's only because they're not courses anymore, because the person who organized it is maybe retired, didn't have a successor and all this sort of stuff. So they were already known by the local authorities, et cetera. And maybe, you know, Tour of the Reservoir would be one that sort of comes to mind for me. But the second thing, of course, then you've got to raise the commercial sponsorship for that. But this came back to sort of one of the fundamental questions that we were asking ourselves, which is, what does the scene need to revive itself? It needs a multi-day stage race. That's one of them. It needs more races in the south of England. You know, it needs more money. It needs better commercial organisation, etc. But it's a glaring hole that there isn't a sort of a multi-day stage race. In Ireland, they obviously have the RAS. We need to bring something like that back to the scene. Now, it can't happen overnight, but that needs to be a stated ambition to bring that to the table as quickly as possible. It definitely couldn't have happened in 2024. But maybe with a lot of discussion, it could happen in 2025 or 2026. But the bottom line is, it needs to happen. Alongside that, of course, which I'm sure we're going to get onto, is the need for UCI races. We need more UCI races in the calendar. In order that we bring teams here, even like, you know, 1.2 level races, effectively, in order that continental teams come to the UK to race, because at the moment all our continental teams are going abroad to race because they haven't got enough races here. So we need to try and solve that. Again, that takes money, organisation, there's administration now and a bit of red tape because of Brexit and all these sorts of things. But it needs to be something that the sport intends to rebuild, more UCI races. And then, of course, we have the third thing that in parallel to our task force, of course, we then had a number of issues which have emerged between British Cycling and Sweet Spot, obviously ultimately now leading to the failure of Sweet Spot, the organisation, and BC now taking ownership of running the two flagship events, the Women's Tour and the Tour of Britain. So that's quite big as well, isn't it? That if BC are going to suddenly organise that, you know, Sweet Spot was almost a dedicated organisation of people doing that. So with a lot of people in it and a lot of smart people and a lot of experience, so all of a sudden that needs to get delivered by BC. So there's quite a lot of internal challenges, I think, for them to step up now and be able to deliver a UCI level stage race, you know, an 8-day stage race fundamentally for the Tour of Britain. It takes one hell of a lot of organising.
I think you make a very good point there, Phil, and you've given a perfect launch pad to the second part of this episode, which was to talk about the other major announcement of the winter. Came a couple of days after the task force's recommendations were published, and that was the announcement from British Cycling that they are going to put a major focus on major events, including the Tour of Britain and the Women's Tour of Britain, formerly known as the Women's Tour, of course. Now, this was announced on February the 2nd by John Dutton up at the National Cycling Centre, and it was described as a new vision, quotes, for major cycling events in Britain. These events are to be delivered by a subsidiary of British Cycling called British Cycling Events, and that is to be led by Jonathan Day, the Federation's interim managing director. Now, British Cycling Events has already delivered rounds of the UCI Track Champions League, and Jonathan Day has been a guest on this podcast. We know that Jono does a great job with the national championships each year. There were five key initiatives announced to support this vision. Top of the list was delivery of the Tour of Britain and the Women's Tour of Britain in 2024 and beyond. And crucially, in the calendar slots previously occupied by Sweet Spot's Women's Tour and Tour of Britain. They're also going to explore the feasibility of a multi-sport urban event series in Britain. They're attempting to build on the success of the UCI Track Champions League and to conduct a feasibility study on a new domestic track league concept. They'll continue to support efforts to secure mountain bike and cyclocross UCI World Cup rounds in Britain. And most importantly for everyone on this call, they also pledged in the same release to implement the task force recommendations. Well, look, let's zoom straight into the Women's Tour and the Tour of Britain. Phil, you hinted at it. Ed, let's get your thoughts on it. Why would BC be able to deliver a Women's Tour and a Tour of Britain when Sweet Spot couldn't?
Well, let's start with John. I think John Dutton, as you mentioned, he has got a great history. He's had a real sort of history of credibility and success in terms of putting on major events, particularly in terms of like bringing different aspects, you know, the elite men's, elite women's, disability sport together and making successful events happen in the past. Is that a guarantee for future success? I guess not, but I think he's shown willing. You know, he's clearly interested in making this work. Like I said, we mentioned earlier that there's been business events happening in central London. They know they need to find some financial support, or they know some financial support from a major title sponsor will help. I guess there's certain inalienable facts of life, aren't there? You know, life's unfair, the goalposts move, there's no guarantees. Now, I'm going to sort of stick with that last one. There's no guarantees right now. I don't know, and I definitely can't predict the future. But I do think they're going to give it the best effort, and I don't think this is... they're not pretending that they want this to happen. I think there's a big impetus within British cycling to try and make things work. So fingers crossed, you know, and I think everyone's got their fingers crossed that they can.
Yeah. I mean, if you had to back one person to get this across the line, it would be John Dutton. And he's organised a Rugby World Cup, for goodness sake, but delivered a Rugby World Cup, I should say, more than organised. He was a major player at last year's Cycling World Championships in Glasgow. And my goodness, if ever we wanted an event that demonstrated the power of major events, that was it. But Phil, is this the right solution for British cycling? John Dutton has a formidable reputation in delivering major events, of course, but is it the right solution for an organisation without a title sponsor?
I don't think they had any choice, Tim. For those people that follow the sport, they will know there's been an ongoing dispute between British Cycling and Sweet Spot, and clearly that has now come to a head with an ultimatum from British Cycling to Sweet Spot. And if you obviously want to know more about that situation, I suggest you just go away and Google that. So now we have what was the Tour of Britain and the Women's Tour, to be renamed the Women's Tour of Britain, in the portfolio of British Cycling. Now, I guess that has a lot of commercial upside. Of course, what that now allows them to do is go to market with these events in their portfolio. However, we should not underestimate the size and scale of the delivery of these multi-day races in the UK. It's a huge ask. And I know John Dutton's got a very bold ambition for British cycling. And of course, I guess we're seeing that beginning to play out here. One thing they're going to have to do is they've got to find some commercial sponsors pretty rapidly. They're also going to need a team behind them back at British Cycling, who can work out all the very, very complex logistics for putting on these multi-day tours. But we have heard earlier in the podcast that John Dutton's got extensive experience, having recently delivered the World Championships up in Scotland, and of course, the Rugby League World Cup. So I guess 2024, we're just going to have to see what happens. I can't imagine that we'll see in 2024 what perhaps is going to be the finished article, but what we will definitely see is a intent to get these races delivered.
Well, we've got everything crossed. These are races of national importance. Ed, just before we leave the topic, you've got an insight here into the public-private interface, the way that local authorities, lower tiers of government, have an interest in cycling, have a stake in cycling. Is there a sense that British cycling could succeed here where Sweet Spot failed? I mean, to take only one example, the cost of police motorcycles at £1,000 per day per bike. Clearly, a commercial organisation like Sweet Spot would have difficulty in renegotiating those terms, but for a federation, publicly funded organisation, would they in some way be better placed to overcome some of the hurdles that Sweet Spot was unable to overcome?
Would a local authority have more trust, more belief in a governing body delivering said event to said standards? Yeah, I think they probably would. I think, if it's something that a local authority in whatever area hadn't engaged in before, I think, yeah, it'd probably give them a little bit of a confidence boost if they were approached by a governing body. We've spoke a lot about it, you know, escalating police costs and things like that. And, you know, this is real big picture political stuff, which, you know, it wasn't in the scope of the elite road racing scene. But hey, let's zoom out and think really big picture here, right? In terms of that, the government's getting ready for a big general election right now, and they've released the plan for the motorist. So, you know, clear time, such a thing could never happen at this point in time. Would there ever be a point in time where British Cycling could approach the higher power in the government and say, hey, can we be helped out with policing costs here? Then, yeah, I do believe a governing body would be better place to do that than a private entity like Sweet Spot, for example. Now, that's pretty big picture thinking. And that's nothing to do with the task force or our recommendations, you know, through the smaller lens of the elite road racing scene. But yeah, I do think if it's in-house, then there's always going to be potential for things like that to happen, even if it's in 4 or 5 years' time.
Yeah, I mean, British Cycling is the federation. And presumably that will open doors that might have been closed to Sweet Spot. Phil, you wanted to come in.
Yes, which is also that obviously the National Federation will also have a public affairs team which will be influencing in government, which is really important. And you know, sometimes the sums of money that are involved, which maybe the Federation might need to make sure that the women's tour, you know, and the Tour of Britain are run in the way that government runs nowadays, are sort of rounding errors, aren't they, in terms of funding? Because we talk now in billions and tens of billions and trillions, don't we, in terms of government debt and all these sorts of things. So if you're going and going, look, can you chuck 10 million our way? And by doing that, you're going to secure these two flagship national races, which are going to put United Kingdom on the map globally. Someone's going to start listening to that. And also, once you know, I think there was a lot of discussion, wasn't there, that the Vuelta, where the government funded all the policing costs, it's all funded and paid for. And it's like, well, can't that just be done, given that the police force is funded through, you know, general taxation and all these sorts of things? You know, can't it just be decreed that those races can have, I don't know, policing provided by the government with a budget coming, you know, from the Department for Media and Sport or something directly? So for those things to happen, you need to be talking right in the centre of government, as Ed knows, and you roll out somebody like Ed and go, there you go, here's one of our triple Olympians who'll be this, you know, the front end of this, here's an ambassador, and you've got to influence, you know, right at the centre in Westminster, ministers to extract a bit of money. And I think John's got a lot of experience with that. And I've already noticed from some of his LinkedIns that he's spending a little bit more time in London and Westminster. And I'm sure there's plenty of lobbying going on behind the scenes to look at how to generate better income streams from the public sector.
Well, watch this space. I mean, the next time you're down in London, Ed, you might find yourself on Downing Street trying to win a few hearts and minds on behalf of our sport. Ed, Phil, thank you very much indeed for joining me today. I mean, to say that we've covered a fair bit of ground would be something of an understatement. We've talked through many of the recommendations of the Elite Road Racing Task Force in depth, and we've got on to the other big story of the winter, which is the future of the Tours of Britain. Thank you very much again, guys, for joining me today, and thank you to everybody out there for listening.
If you've enjoyed today's episode, please hit subscribe.